your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make to have in the middle of it. Rest make to have in the middle. We are. Rest make to have in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We broadcast every Saturday night from Austin, Texas, 7 to 9 p.m. Our website is www.thesecrettruth.com. And I'm a co-host along with Charlotte Littlefield Brown. Here we've been broadcasting for over 12 years. So we're going to start off. We've got just a crazy week going on. We've got a standoff occurring between the president and the Democrats over the immigration bill and the funding that has been totally put about 25% of our government offline or out of the loop, you could say, of being paid or closed down, you could say. But we've got about a clip coming up here of an interview between Alex Jones and Peter Schiff. And they're discussing the economy, and I think Peter Schiff lays it out what's going on during the Obama administration and then what Trump is trying to deal with now. So listen to this very carefully. It's very insightful. Here we go now.
What he inherited from Obama was a disaster. I mean, that's why Trump was elected, because the recovery was phony. It was all engineered by cheap money and 0% interest rates and quantitative easing. That prevented the economy from going through a badly needed restructuring. It allowed the government to run enormous deficits under Obama without pushing interest rates up. And it pushed up the value of stocks and real estate so people could feel wealthier, even though they weren't. And all of that, those assets collateralized all sorts of debt. We borrowed a lot of money during that time because of these inflated real estate prices and stock prices. And then Trump walks in and he kind of, you know, adds air to the bubble by cutting taxes, but letting government spending continue to grow. So we had more debt. We postponed the bursting of that bubble. So instead of it bursting, you know, early in his administration, now it's going to burst halfway through. And that means that the air is going to come out for the next 2 years, and we're going to be in a worse recession than the Great Recession when Trump is up for reelection. And that's going to be very difficult. You know, the last president to run for reelection during a recession was Jimmy Carter. And that didn't work out well for Carter, but it worked out well for the nation because we got Ronald Reagan. Well, this time we're going to get the opposite of Ronald Reagan. We're going to end up with a Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren type socialist as president in 2020 with the full support of a socialist Congress. So I think we have some dark days ahead, unfortunately. I really want to toot my horn so much as sound the alarm. And because, you know, I've been saying this since Trump was inaugurated, but, you know, he inherited that big, fat, ugly bubble. And the problem was he owns it now because, unfortunately, he called it a boom and claimed credit for it, but he's going to own the bust. Remember that what he inherited from Obama was a disaster. I mean, that's why Trump was elected, because the recovery was phony. It was all engineered by cheap money and 0% interest rates and quantitative easing. That prevented the economy from going through a badly needed restructuring. It allowed the government to run enormous deficits under Obama without pushing interest rates up. And it pushed up the value of stocks and real estate so people could feel wealthier, even though they weren't. And all of that, those assets collateralized all sorts of debt. We borrowed a lot of money during that time because of these inflated real estate prices and stock prices. And then Trump walks in and he kind of, you know, adds air to the bubble by cutting taxes, but letting government spending continue to grow. So we had more debt. We postponed the bursting of that bubble. So instead of it bursting, you know, early in his administration, now it's going to burst halfway through. And that means that the air is going to come out for the next 2 years, and we're going to be in a worse recession than the Great Recession when Trump is up for reelection. And that's going to be very difficult. You know, the last president to run for reelection during a recession was Jimmy Carter. And that didn't work out well for Carter, but it worked out well for the nation because we got Ronald Reagan. Well, this time we're going to get the opposite of Ronald Reagan. We're going to end up with a Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren-type socialist as president in 2020 with the full support of a socialist Congress. So I think we have some dark days ahead, unfortunately. I don't think the president has a lot of fans at the Federal Reserve, but I don't know that those guys are smart enough to know how to target them. But, you know, I actually think that had the Fed not raised rates, it would be worse right now, because the only reason the dollar hasn't imploded is because the Fed is raising rates and because people believe they're going to continue to raise rates. Now, I don't. I do believe that before, you know, Trump is finished with this term, rates will be back at zero and the Federal Reserve is going to be doing quantitative easing all over again. And the dollar hasn't really gone anywhere. It's been going sideways because people still believe that the economy is much stronger than it is and that the Fed is going to be able to deliver more rate hikes. But, you know, we haven't had economic growth really under Trump. We've just spent more borrowed money. You know, Trump likes to talk about how we're having a resurgence in manufacturing, but we're not. The manufacturing numbers are terrible. The trade deficits under Trump are bigger than they've ever been. Yeah, I mean, look, they're socialists. I mean, communism, fascism, they're all forms of socialism. It's basically a belief that, you know, that the free market doesn't work and that the government should do everything. And clearly, that's where the heart of the Democratic Party is right now. And we're moving in that direction. And that's why I'm afraid that Trump is going to get blamed. This crisis that's going to happen, Trump didn't cause it, right? Yeah, you know, first of all, though, I got a few things in common with you. You know, CNBC banned me about 2 years ago, so I haven't been on there in a long time. You know, the last time I was supposed to be on was a couple of years ago. I was scheduled to be on with Rick Santelli, who used to invite me on quite a bit. And then I got canceled last minute and I haven't been invited on since. And Rick had no idea why I got canceled, but that was my last scheduled appearance. I get on Fox Business every once in a while, but I mean, I'm not on CNN anymore. I'm not on Bloomberg. They banned me. They were the first to probably ban me 8-9 years ago after I was on almost every week before the financial crisis. So they don't like, you know, my opinion getting out there. But let me just get back to, you know, what we're talking about with Trump. You know, because Trump claimed credit for the boom and said it was he did it with his policies and he made America great again. Because of that, when this whole thing comes crashing down in the second half of his term, he has made it so easy for the Democrats to blame him. I mean, this is going to be easier than it was blaming Bush for the 2008 crisis. That's what made it so easy for Obama to beat John McCain. Well, it's going to be even easier for whoever the Democrats nominate to beat Trump when we are in a massive recession, and they're going to blame it on tax cuts, on deregulation, on everything that Trump did is going to get blamed. What Trump should have done when he was first elected, instead of trying to be popular and trying to make it easy, he should have basically delivered the bad news and basically said, look, you know, we've had 8 years of a phony economy. In fact, it began long before Obama. We have to deflate this bubble. We're going to have to go through a protracted recession to get our economic house in order. If we want to make America great again, here's what we need to do. We need to shrink government. We need to cut government spending. We need to rein in entitlements. We need to cut regulations so we can produce and save. We need higher interest rates. The stock market's going to come down. The real estate market's going to come down. But if we want to produce again and export and do all these things that we did when we were great, this is what we need to do. We need to swallow this bitter tasting medicine. But Trump didn't want any part of that. He became a big cheerleader for everything he criticized. All of a sudden, he wanted more cheap money. He wanted higher stock prices. He wanted, you know, he wanted more spending. He just wanted to keep the bubble going before he got out of Dodge. And he wanted to claim credit for the bubble. The problem is, He's not going to get out of Dodge. I don't want to give somebody credit for pumping a bubble. I want credit for letting the bubble deflate. Bubbles are a problem. They distort the economy. They can feel good just like drugs, but I don't want to encourage somebody to become a heroin addict. At least you could smoke marijuana. You can't do anything with Bitcoin or any of these cryptocurrencies, so they're going to zero. Some of these pot stocks will survive, but yeah, most of them are probably way overvalued because people don't, you know, understand how much competition is actually going to be in this market when the big tobacco companies are finally getting involved. But, you know, yeah, I applaud the fact that you resisted the temptation to subject your audience to a Ponzi scheme. I'm sure a lot of people in the crypto universe wanted to get you pumping all those coins so they can dump them on your audience. And it's good for you that you didn't fall for that. Yeah, and you know, we're not finished going down. I mean, people made money if they got in early, but of course those gains are going to equal the losses by all the people who got in late. And by the time they were trying to pump, pay you to pump it, it was late. They weren't trying to get you to pump Bitcoin when it was $1 or $5. Bitcoin is just a microcosm for the whole United States. Our whole economy is a gigantic bubble. And you know, had Hillary Clinton won, I don't think the Fed ever would have raised rates again. Trump enabled them to get in a few more hikes by blowing more air into the bubble. And you talk about the 3% GDP growth. We only got that for a couple of quarters. I'm not even sure if we're going to be at 3% for all of 2018. We didn't get it for 2017. But whatever the GDP ends up being this year, this is going to be the high watermark. We're going down. We're probably going to be in a recession in GDP next year. Well, the Great Depression is going to happen after the Democrats get in 2020. I mean, you know, because I guess the good news is they're going to screw it up even more. I mean, if you want to call that good news, because we might have a shot of taking back the country in 2024. But, you know, Hoover, you know, was in office when the Depression started, but it really didn't become a depression until Roosevelt made it a depression by basically taking all the failed policies of Hoover and expanding them. And so I think when the Democrats take over this massive recession, they will turn it into a depression, except it's going to be an inflationary depression, not just stagnation, an actual recession. I'm talking about big inflation and recession at the same time. In the 1970s, I don't think the economy was actually contracting. I think it was still going up. But, you know, a lot of it has to do with the way they calculate inflation. So it's probably happened, but the government hasn't officially acknowledged it because of the way they score it. I haven't changed my strategy. I've been investing the same way. But to me, it's amazing that this bubble has gone on this big. And again, had Trump not been elected, it would have popped 2 years ago. And I think the dollar would already be falling. Gold would already be taken off because the Fed would already be back in zero. They'd already be doing quantitative easing. So I think people should be getting out of the dollar before the bottom drops out, getting out of overpriced U.S. stocks and bonds, getting into better valued assets outside the United States. Well, I think all the commodities are ultimately going to go up. I think gold is going to go up the most. So I think you're going to see a deflation in that. I think commodity prices will fall in terms of real money, which is gold and silver. But I think prices are going to rise in terms of, you know, all these paper substitutes. I think initially when it first got started, there was a lot of well-intentioned people in there that, you know, didn't like the central banks and fiat currencies and were looking for an alternative. And, you know, I just don't believe that these cryptocurrencies ultimately can be money. They just don't have the qualities that you need to be money. But what happened as a bubble started in these things and the prices went up, that's when all that money came in to try to profit from it. And that's when you had all the pump and dumpers and all the scams and the hysteria. You know, I had clients, I had to talk clients calling me up when Bitcoin was $15,000, wanting to put their entire IRA because they thought it's going to $1 million. You know, I had to talk a lot of people out of that. I mean, nobody was calling me up when Bitcoin was $10 or $100, but when it was $10,000, $15,000, I mean, people kept calling and there was a lot of hysteria, but it was all a bunch of nonsense. And yeah, all these currencies, there's 2,000 or so different cryptocurrencies. None of them have any real value, but as long as people think they're going up because they think there's a greater fool, in fact, they don't even know it's a greater fool because they just think that this is, you know, this revolution. And I talk to these guys, there's a lot of them here in Puerto Rico where I live that have come down here. And some of these guys are still passionate about it, and I hear them talk about it, and they don't even realize they're saying a bunch of nonsense. Nothing makes sense, but they think, you know, I'm just some old fool who doesn't get it. You know, they're so trapped in their own bubble, they can't see it. And it's ironic because nobody can see their own bubble. The people who are in Bitcoin, oh, they can see the bubble in the dollar or the stock market or the real estate market. but they don't see the bubble in Bitcoin. Just like a lot of people on Wall Street, a lot of the money is still just on paper, right? Because it doesn't really exist. It's just a price. You know, you don't, it's not real until you cash out. The people who made money were the people who cashed out, who got in early and cashed out. But then you had all these companies that got started, all this malinvestment. People are anticipating institutional demand and all this stuff happening. This is all malinvestment. It's all going to be liquidated. But again, this is a microcosm of the broader economy. This is just one of the bubbles that has been created by central bankers. And, you know, but you have to have a real safe haven. You know, I think a lot of people who got distracted, they should have been buying gold and they got caught up in cryptocurrencies. They should come back to gold while they can and get into some real safe haven investments. That's what I'm trying to do with my clients at Euro Pacific Capital through my asset management company that I run here in Puerto Rico, is really prepare people for the collapse. False confidence is a very dangerous thing, whether it's confidence in the economy or confidence in cryptocurrencies. It causes you to do things that you shouldn't do. And you can get excited that, yes, the president got a lot of people to be optimistic early on, but all these people are going to be disappointed when their optimism turns out to be unwarranted, and they're going to take out their frustrations on Trump and other Republicans. That is the problem. Now, what could he do now to repair the damage? I don't know if it's repairable. I mean, he has to come out and basically say, I was wrong. The economy isn't great. I didn't make America great again. I made the big, fat, ugly bubble bigger, fatter, and uglier. But now, you know, I've come to my senses, and this is what we need to do. And we have to slash government spending, and I have to cut Social Security and Medicare. And, you know, we're going to have the stock market going way down. And he didn't build it, but he branded it with a big giant T. I mean, what he should have done is, if he would have bit the bullet day one and used his popularity and, hey, I am not a career politician. I'm a statesman. I'm not doing what's politically. I don't care about my own reelection. Let's just finally get this house in order, and done it day one. Yes, the stock market never would have gone up. We would have had a bear market right away. We would have gone right into recession. We would have dealt with our problems instead of kicking the can down the road for a couple more years while the problems got bigger. Now it's going to be too late. Trump made it so much easier for Bernie Sanders or whoever he, you know, handpicks as his successor to win. That is the problem. Things are now going to get so bad, and it's all going to be blamed on lower taxes on the rich and corporations and deregulation and whatever Trump stands for. That's what's going to be blamed on. And now the public is going to grasp for the only savior they've got left, which is going to be a socialist who is going to promise everything's going to be better. Just trust the government. We tried capitalism. It didn't work. It didn't work under Bush. It was a disaster under Trump. You know, everything was great after Obama. Trump screwed it all up with his capitalism and his business and his tax cuts.
Sure.
Now we have to have socialized medicine, government guaranteed jobs, you know, $15 minimum wage. Again, they are going to turn this recession into an inflationary depression. And we have one shot to take our country back, and that's 2024. Because if we don't turn away from socialism in 2024, we'll never turn away from it. I mean, it'll be here forever, right? Just like the New Deal programs, only this is a much worse deal. The establishment is, you know, is changing. I mean, who is actually in the establishment? I mean, if you look at the Democratic Party, it is shifting to the left. You know, more and more people are buying into this nonsense. And so the establishment is going to look different in 2020 than it has looked in the past. It's going to be much more, you know, socialist minded. And this legislation is going to come in. Now, of course, there's always people who are going to be able to survive socialism. There's always a handful of wealthy people that are well connected that manage to preserve their wealth. But the vast majority of people are going to suffer. The people who are going to suffer the most are the people who think they're going to benefit the most. It's all the poor or the middle class that are buying into this nonsense. It's a good thing she's not 35. Otherwise, she might be able to run for president and win. That's how ridiculous this is. You know, but hopefully the Supreme Court can save us, because, you know, if we get a few good justices in there, if the Supreme Court could actually rise to the occasion, because in the past, I think the judiciary has been a failure. I mean, because they've let the people down. They haven't forced the government to abide by the Constitution. But, you know, they might be our last defense against a lot of this stuff that the Democrats are going to pass through Congress and that a socialist will sign. Maybe the Supreme Court will strike it down, because all this stuff is not authorized by the Constitution. And so we'll see. You know, we finally had a decent justice, in Texas said Obamacare was unconstitutional, which it is. And so hopefully that decision will survive. I don't know. They're trying to keep her aboard alive, but she should resign at this point if she's.
That was Peter Schiff. And, with Alex saying very little, I think Alex lets Peter Schiff speak up quite a bit, but Peter Schiff is predicting a really decline, an economic decline, perhaps a recession or depression of some kind. So we just got to be very careful in evaluating the future. I know that Trump has been very critical of the Federal Reserve Bank. And I think he has been because with rising interest rates, you can kill off an economic expansion. But one of the very insightful things that I picked up over the years about a world economic problems is at the World Economic Council, I said this last week briefly. I'll expand on my thoughts a little bit more this evening. But they last year, there was very little talk about the debt bubble, you could say. But the two previous years at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, there was great talk about that. And Rudolph, one of the leading writers out of Harvard on debt and the debt crisis and the debt problem, was very, very quiet about it at last year's Davos meeting. Now, we've got one coming up this next January within 30 days here. And I'm going to monitor that and give you our listening audience an update just to see, you know, where we're at. But, we'll have to see the banking crisis that first raised its ugly head in 2008 has not been solved. They started off, and then Peter Schiff is saying that earlier, in this program is that they started off with quantitative easing and they just gave credit, unlimited credit to everyone and to quite a few international banks. And the Deutsche Bank was one of those in Germany that they saved with a lot of credit. I think that was the number one quantitative easing recipient of the quantitative easing credits. So what they did was just, they just, you know, really quantitative easing just pumped a lot of dollars into these institutions to keep them from going totally belly up. And it did save them temporarily. But now what we've got to see is that there's a tremendous debt of all kinds on all levels out there. And whether or not we're going to be able to overcome that debt and begin to reduce that debt and to be softened again remains to be seen. So we'll have to wait and see what other economists, but the economists are all fooled about some of this. So you can't always believe what these economists say. And one will say this and one will say that. And you don't really, you can't get really a bottom line on it. There was great talk going on of what was in the notes that were given to several people, several of the presidents and so forth. And I think Hillary got one at the George Herbert Walker Bush funeral in Washington, D.C. And it was the one that Trump was at. Trump and Melania walked in and joined the seating with all the presidents there on the front row. And there was a envelope that was placed into some of the programs underneath some of the seats. So I know Hillary, when she opened hers, she was devastated. And then I think one of the Secret Service agents provided slip to George W. Bush an envelope. He gave it to Laura. She opened it, read it, and she was devastated, showed it to Jeb sitting next to her right. But anyway, there's all kinds of speculation about what that note said. And there's all kinds of – there's ongoing, you know, QAnon, you know, information all over the web about sealed indictments and things like this. They're even saying that they executed George Herbert Walker Bush and he consented to it and they had indicted him, except him. Well, I'm not seeing proof of this yet, so I'm not going for that. But he was up in age. He was not in good health. So he was nearing the end of his life one way or another. So, but anyway, the the speculation is rife out there. And when you go into to YouTube, you're going to see a series of different broadcasters. Now they're dwelling on the envelopes. And some have some very interesting conjectures and so forth, and some theories and hypotheses and so forth, and opinions of what might be in there. Some said it could have been something about 9/11 tying the top Cabell to 9/11 and all those top people there. The others are saying that it could have been something about, well, we've been listening to everybody now, and Trump knows everything about all of y'all, or something. Could have been something along those lines. I know George Herbert Walker Bush was good at writing little notes to people over his career. And say, so one hypothesis was that he wrote something like, they know it all. I'm sorry. Sorry, they know it all. And then George, you know, so there was, you know, that little note that was given, see, to those insiders that set up Trump. And they went after him, Obama, all of them. It's been brought out on Hannity. Sean Hannity's program, Sarah Carter and all these people, John Solomon, and, Judicial Watch. There's just a building of a great amount of evidence about Uranium One and so forth. So what is going to happen to all this? We don't have any firm indictments yet. There's more than enough information, though, that Trump has to indict the whole bunch. Now, whether that will be done or whether they're going to use the intimidation tool of the impeachment to keep him from indicting them, and they're all going to get off, see. That could be very well be what could turn out. I've sort of thought, and expressed an opinion before in this program, that they could just be like a Mexican standoff where they agree not to impeach him and he agrees not to indict the very top leaders, but to have them step back from the indictment, he'll step back from the investigations of the top leadership, and they'll end up sacrificing some of the lower level people. So that could be it. So I'm not sure what we're going to see. A speech was given recently at the German Marshall Fund organization by Secretary of State Pompeo. And he lays out a very, very beautiful speech about bringing back the nation state. And so I'm going to play that next. Here we go now.
All of you, thank you for joining me here today. It's wonderful to be in this beautiful place to get a chance to make a set of remarks about the very work that you do, the issues that confront the Marshall Fund and confront our region as well. Before I start today with my formal remarks, I would be enormously remiss if I did not pay a well-deserved tribute to America's 41st president, George Herbert Walker Bush. He was, many of you know him, he was an unyielding champion of freedom around the world, first as a fighter pilot in World War II, later as a congressman. He was the ambassador to the United Nations and then an envoy to China. He then had the same job I had as the director of the CIA. I did it for longer than he did. He was then the vice president under Ronald Reagan. I got to know him some myself. He was a wonderful brother, a father, a grandfather, and a proud American. Indeed, America is the only country he loved more than Texas. I actually think that he would be delighted for me to be here today at an institution named after a fellow lover of freedom, George Marshall. And he would have been thrilled to see all of you here, such a large crowd gathered who are dedicated to transatlantic bonds so many decades after they were first forged. You know, the men who rebuilt Western civilization after World War II, like my predecessor, Secretary Marshall, knew that only strong U.S. leadership, in concert with our friends and allies, could unite sovereign nations all around the globe. So we underwrote new institutions to rebuild Europe and Japan, to stabilize currencies, and to facilitate trade. We all co-founded NATO to guarantee security for ourselves and for our allies. We entered into treaties to codify Western values of freedom and human rights. Collectively, we convene multilateral organizations to promote peace and cooperation among states. And we worked hard, indeed tirelessly, to preserve Western ideals because, as President Trump made clear in his Warsaw Address, each of those are worth preserving. This American leadership allowed us to enjoy the greatest human flourishing in modern history. We won the Cold War. We won the peace. With no small measure of George H.W. Bush's effort, we reunited Germany. This is the type of leadership that President Trump is boldly reasserting. After the Cold War ended, we allowed this global order to begin to corrode. It failed us in some places, and sometimes it failed you and the rest of the world. Multilateralism has, too often, become viewed as an end unto itself. The more treaties we sign, the safer we supposedly are, the more bureaucrats we have, the better the job gets done. Was that ever really true? The central question that we face is the question of whether the system as currently configured, as it exists today, and as the world exists today, does it work? Does it work for all the people of the world? Today, at the United Nations, peacekeeping missions drag on for decades, no closer to peace. The UN's climate-related treaties are viewed by some nations as simply a vehicle to redistribute wealth. Anti-Israel bias has been institutionalized. Regional powers collude to vote the likes of Cuba and Venezuela onto the Human Rights Council. You know, the UN was founded as an organization that welcomed peace-loving nations. I asked today, does it continue to serve its mission faithfully? In the Western Hemisphere, has enough been done with the Organization of American States to promote its four pillars of democracy, human rights, security, and economic development in a region that includes the likes of Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua? In Africa, does the African Union advance the mutual interests of its nation-state members? For the business community from which I came, consider this. The World Bank and the International Monetary Fund were chartered to help rebuild war-torn territories and promote private investment and growth. Today, these institutions often counsel countries who have mismanaged their economic affairs to impose austerity measures that inhibit growth and crowd out private sector actors. Here, in Brussels, the European Union and its predecessors have delivered a great deal of prosperity to the entire continent. Europe is America's single largest trading partner, and we benefit enormously from your success. But Brexit, if nothing else, was a political wake-up call. Is the EU ensuring that interests of countries and their citizens are placed before those of bureaucrats here in Brussels? These are valid questions. This leads to my next point. Bad actors have exploited our lack of leadership for their own gain. This is the poisoned fruit of American retreat. President Trump is determined to reverse that. China's economic development did not lead to an embrace of democracy and regional stability. It led to more political repression and regional provocations. We welcomed China into the liberal order, but never policed its behavior. China has routinely exploited loopholes in the World Trade Organization rules, imposed market restrictions, forced technology transfers, and stolen intellectual property. And it knows that world opinion is powerless to stop its Orwellian human rights violations. Iran didn't join the community of nations after the nuclear deal was inked. It spread its newfound riches to terrorists and to dictators. Tehran holds multiple American hostages, and Bob Levinson has been missing there for 11 years. Iran has blatantly disregarded UN Security Council resolutions, lied to the International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors about its nuclear program, and evaded UN sanctions. Just this past week, Iran test-fired ballistic missile a ballistic missile in violation of UN Security Council Resolution 2231. Earlier this year, Tehran used the U.S.-Iran Treaty of Amity to bring baseless claims against the United States before the International Court of Justice. Most all of this malign activity during the JCPOA. Russia. Russia hasn't embraced Western values of freedom and international cooperation. Rather, it has suppressed opposition voices and invaded the sovereign nations of Georgia and of Ukraine. Moscow has also deployed a military-grade nerve agent on foreign soil, right here in Europe, in violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention, to which it is a party. And as I'll detail later today, Russia has violated the Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces Treaty for many years. The list goes on. We have to account for the world order of today in order to chart the way forward. It is what America's national security strategy deemed principled realism. I like to think of it as common sense. Every nation must honestly acknowledge its responsibility to its citizens and ask if the current international order serves the good of its people as well as it could. And if not, we must ask how we can right it. This is what President Trump is doing. He is returning the United States to its traditional, central leadership role in the world. He sees the world as it is, not as we wish it to be. He knows that nothing can replace the nation state as the guarantor of democratic freedoms and national interests. He knows, as George H.W. Bush knew, that a safer world has consistently demanded American courage on the world stage. And when we, all of us, ignore our responsibilities to the institutions we formed, others will abuse them. Critics in places like Iran and China, who really are undermining the international order, are saying that the Trump administration is the reason that the system is breaking down. They claim America is acting unilaterally instead of multilaterally, as if every kind of multilateral action is by definition desirable. Even our European friends sometimes say we're not acting in the world's interest. This is just plain wrong. Our mission is to reassert our sovereignty, reform the liberal international order, and we want our friends to help us and to exert their sovereignty as well. We aspire to make the international order serve our citizens, not to control them. America intends to lead now and always. Under President Trump, we are not abandoning international leadership or our friends in the international system. Indeed, quite the contrary. Just look, as one example, at the historic number of countries which have gotten on board our pressure campaign against North Korea. No other nation in the world could have rallied dozens of nations from every corner of the world to impose sanctions on the regime in Pyongyang. International bodies must help facilitate cooperation that bolsters the security and values of the free world, or they must be reformed or eliminated. When treaties are broken, the violators must be confronted, and the treaties must be fixed or discarded. Words should mean something. Our administration is thus lawfully exiting or renegotiating outdated or harmful treaties, trade agreements, and other international arrangements that do not serve our sovereign interests or the interests of our allies. We announced our intent to withdraw from the Paris Agreement on climate change, absent better terms for the United States. The current pact would have siphoned money from American paychecks and enriched polluters like China. In America, we've found a better solution. We think a better solution for the world. We've unleashed our energy companies to innovate and compete, and our carbon emissions have declined dramatically. We changed course from the Iran deal because of, among other things, Tehran's violent and destabilizing activities, which undermined the spirit of the deal and put the safety of American people and our allies at risk. In its place, we are leading our allies to constrain Iran's revolutionary ambitions and end Iran's campaigns of global terrorism. And we needn't a new bureaucracy to do it. We need to continue to develop a coalition which will achieve that outcome, which will keep people in the Middle East, in Europe, and the entire world safe from the threat from Iran. America renegotiated our treaty, NAFTA, to advance the interests of the American worker. President Trump proudly signed the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement at the G20 this past weekend in Buenos Aires. And on Friday, it will submit it to the Congress, a body accountable to the American people. The new agreement also includes renegotiation provisions because no trade agreement is permanently suited to all times. We have encouraged our G20 partners to reform the WTO, and they took a good first step in Buenos Aires this last week. I spoke earlier about the World Bank and the IMF. The Trump administration is working to refocus these institutions on policies that promote economic prosperity, pushing to halt lending to nations that can already access global capital markets, countries like China, and pressing to reduce taxpayer handouts to development banks that are perfectly capable of raising private capital on their own. We're also taking leadership, real action, to stop rogue international courts like the International Criminal Court from trampling on our sovereignty, your sovereignty, and all of our freedoms. The ICC's Office of the Prosecutor is trying to open an investigation into U.S. personnel in connection with the war in Afghanistan. We will take all necessary steps to protect our people, those of our NATO allies who fight alongside of us inside of Afghanistan, from unjust prosecution. Because we know if it can happen to our people, it can happen to yours too. It is a worthy question. Does the court continue to serve its original intended purpose? The first 2 years of the Trump administration demonstrate that President Trump is not undermining these institutions, nor is he abandoning American leadership. Quite the opposite. In the finest traditions of our great democracy, we are rallying the noble nations of the world to build a new liberal order that prevents war and achieves greater prosperity for all. We're supporting institutions that we believe can be improved. Institutions that work in American interests and yours, in service of our shared values. For example, here in Belgium, in 1973, banks from 15 countries formed SWIFT, developed common standards for cross-border payments, and it's now an integral part of our global financial infrastructure. SWIFT recently disconnected sanctioned Iranian banks from its platform because of the unacceptable risk they pose to the system as a whole. This is an excellent example of American leadership working alongside an international institution to act responsibly. Another example, the Proliferation Security Initiative, formed by 11 nations under the Bush administration to stop trafficking in weapons of mass destruction. It has since grown organically to 105 countries and has undoubtedly made the world safer. And I can't forget standing here, one of the most important international institutions of them all, which will continue to thrive with American leadership. My very first trip, within hours of having been sworn in as a Secretary of State, I traveled here to visit with our NATO allies. I'll repeat this morning what I said then. This is an indispensable institution. President Trump wants everyone to pay their fair share so we can deter our enemies and defend the people of our countries. To that end, all NATO allies should work to strengthen what is already the greatest military alliance in all of history. Never has an alliance been so powerful or so peaceful, and our historic ties must continue. To that end, I'm pleased to announce that I will host my foreign minister colleagues for a meeting in Washington next April, where we will mark NATO's 70th anniversary. As my remarks come to a close, I want to repeat what George Marshall told the UN General Assembly back near the time of its formation in 1948. He said, quote, "International organizations cannot take the place of national and personal effort or of local and individual imagination. International action cannot replace self-help." End of quote. You know, sometimes it's not popular to buck the status quo, to call out that which we all see but sometimes refuse to speak about. But frankly, too much is at stake for all of us in this room today not to do so. This is the reality that President Trump so viscerally understands. Just as George Marshall's generation gave life to a new vision for a safe and free world, so we call on you to have the same kind of boldness. Our call is especially urgent in light of the threats we face from powerful countries and actors whose ambition is to reshape the international order in its own illiberal image. Let's work together. Let's work together to preserve the free world so that it continue to serve the interests of the people to whom we each are accountable. Let's do so in a way that creates international organizations that are agile, that respect national sovereignty, that deliver on their stated missions, and that create value for the liberal order and for the world. President Trump understands deeply that when America leads, peace and prosperity almost certainly follow. He knows that if America and our allies here in Europe don't lead, others will choose to do so. America will, as it has always done, continue to work with our allies around the world towards the peaceful liberal order each citizen of the world deserves. Thank you for joining me here today. May the good Lord bless each and every one of you. Thank you.
This is the reason why they're against Trump, because Trump's against the New World Order. He's against the world government and all that stuff. He's trying to reorder this country and put it back into a nation state status, and they don't want that. And to go over there, Secretary of State Pompeo, and speak to this German Marshall Fund, and they're all of the people they're trying to bring about the New World Order. He was speaking, he was in the lion's den in that room today. So for him to stand up and say what he stood up and said took a lot of guts, and he actually expounded on what Trump is all about. I played a clip a couple of weeks ago of Steve Bannon, and he went over to the Oxford group and delivered a speech there along the same way. But now to have our Secretary of State go into the lion's den and declare, look, we're back to nation state formation. We're giving up this New World Order and all of this world government stuff, and we want to reorder, and we're thinking about America first. And I think Trump was very, very consistent in all of his speeches that I heard across the nation that that's what he wanted to do, see. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's back to attack. But like I said earlier in this hour, those little envelopes passed out to those people there, Hillary and Bill and all those people got those envelopes, and Barack Obama got one. Michelle Obama saw it. Laura Bush saw it and was devastated looking, and Jeb Bush sitting to her right didn't look much better. I mean, they were all shook up. We don't know exactly what was said, but Trump is shaking things up. And that's why I really fear for his safety. And we've got to be very, very cautious here. And we've got to be helpful to try to preserve what he's trying to get to, you know. He has some problems, you know. He did go over there and address the troops at Christmas in Iraq. And he came back and flew back through Ramstein there in Germany. And he met with a group there also, and now they were accusing him of signing hats, the Make America Great Again hats. And later on, there was a news release. He didn't take any hats over there. It's not against federal law or whatever to sign people's hats that if you're visiting like that. It's not considered to be a campaign activity. It's just between you and the individual, and you're not rallying, you're not having a camp. He is the president. He went there to visit the troops overseas. So if someone comes up with a Make America Great hat again, he could sign it without any problems whatsoever. But they continually are just conjuring up all kinds of, violations, say, that he committed. You know, he did this, he did that. He should have signed this, he shouldn't have signed that. You know what I mean? I mean, it's getting to be where it's so obviously wrong now that it's not going to work. There was an explosion recently in New York of a Con Edison plant, and there was a very blue haze created in the sky over the plant after when it exploded. And so that's very, 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 very mysterious what happened there. The president is tweeting out. He says, come on in. He said, I'm here in the White House. Let's make a deal. He's actually almost begging to a degree. But you know what's going to happen. Pelosi's over there in Hawaii, they said. And so she's visiting. She's having a good time over there. And on vacation at a very, very expensive hotel. You know, it's been written just recently. And then I think Maxine Waters is out in the Bahamas somewhere vacationing. So these people, when they get to Washington, they start making big money one way or another. And so they're out there spending it and having a good vacation. And Trump did cancel his Christmas plans in Florida. And Melania flew back from Florida. And that's when they decided, I don't know when they decided it, but they went over to Iraq. And they shook hands and met the troops and were with them for Christmas. And it was the day after Christmas, I think on the 26th. But they did get over there, you know. And that's what really counts, is that they made the effort. There's a lot of work being, the First Lady and the President of the United States. I mean, and one thing about Trump, he works at the job. I will say that. He puts his energy into it. Just like the energy that it took to build the Trump Towers and the hotel chain and all that, he does work. He's not lazy at all. And some of the criticism of Barack Obama was that he wouldn't read this and wouldn't read that, and it would, you know, it just did not work at the job. We got other news also. It's Sears. Sears is going broke. And they're reaching out for a lifeline, and there was chairman of the board came up with a $4 billion offer of a little over 500 of the stores. I believe they own Kmart also. So they don't know how that's going to work out. But anyway, the Congress is closed down. We're not going to see anything occur now. This is Saturday. And, we're just going, the Democrats don't want to make a deal before they gain control of the House. And then they're going to rewrite a whole thing and try to push something through and just, you know, blackmail the president with some kind of audacious type of new bill coming out of the House. And that's basically what I see that's going to go on, you know. The blast in New York turned the sky blue. There was panic and confusion, and it was a rare phenomenon. They didn't know what happened up there. They had said that some kind of electrical, you know, blew up there at the plant, and that's about all they put out so far. But it goes on and on and on. It's really mind-boggling what's happening in the country. We're having the Congress taken over by the Democrats. There's going to be Adam Schiff, head up one of the committees, and he's just prevaricator of a mass, bending of truth and just outright fibbing, you know, and white lying all the time. And, he's such a treacherous people. And they can't even, the Democrats hate, that they begin to hate the Republicans, and some of the good guys up there are just trying like crazy to do good investigations that will benefit the country. But the Democrats up there, I'm afraid, they don't care about investigation to benefit the country. They just don't want their party. They're totally partisan politics. They don't care about the country at all. They just care about the Democratic Party and get more votes and smuggle people in and put them on the illegal, you know, voter roll and run them in there and vote for the Democrats, because the Democrats are the good guys and the Republicans are the bad guys. And just like they always default back to emotions about these children that died recently, a little girl, and little boy, you know, and so they want to blame it either on the system or even that some are even going as far to blame it on Trump. Now, how do you get there from there? Just can't go that route. There's no reason to be even able to do that. And I think when you're traveling like that, sometimes you don't have the water or you didn't think about giving your child the water they needed. And they're coming in there with all kinds of disease, too. So there's no telling what exactly the results of the autopsies will be if they do those. So, I mean, the children died, and it's very sad. We had a shooting of a policeman, a very beloved policeman out in California, in the Joaquin Valley, and he finally, you could say the suspect was stopped in Bakersfield, California. Actually, he was surrounded in a house. They got onto him being in a house. They surrounded the house, and he was inside. He came out with his hands up. So they did get the suspect in that cop shooting. And the policeman was a very nice person. What's so ironic about this, he was a naturalized citizen, and the guy that shot him killed him, supposedly. You know, this is a suspect we're talking about now. We don't want to jump the gun on this. And, you know, they're not guilty until proven guilty. They're innocent until proven guilty. So the suspect in this case supposedly shot this policeman who was a naturalized citizen, killed him, and then ran off. And they got the car. They know the car that he was in, so they quickly could identify who he was. And then they've been on the lookout for him. And there was a manhunt, a big network of manhunt. A net was out, and they arrested him in Bakersfield, California. They surrounded a house he was in. And now I think they've arrested some of the people that they believe helped him hide out there and get away to that house. And so that they were, you know, accessories on some basis there. I want to thank everybody for listening out there. And we're just going to do the best thing we can. And Trump does care about the nation state. He does care about this country. And he did go over Christmas and visited with our troops. You got to say, give him a check mark on that one. And Melania, I tell you, she's a very gracious person. She's very, very sincere. One thing about Melania I like, she doesn't speak out of turn. She's very cautious when she speaks. She's very sincere. She's a very sweet person. And her sincerity, I guess, a very kind and considerate and very sincere. Well, I want to thank everybody for listening, and thank you very much out there in the radio land. And we'll be back next week, 7 to 9, here in Austin, Texas. And Charlotte's going to pay a visit. She's been out of state for a while. She's going to come down and visit with us. And we'll probably get on the air with a program with both of us at that time. Otherwise, start listening to this stuff. Get in there and listen to these programs on both sides. Trump doesn't always have his facts straight, and this is one of the criticisms that is opened up. They can easily criticize him for not always having his facts straight, which he's not good at sometimes. But otherwise, I think he's a very sincere person about the country. Well, thank you for listening. And good night, and good luck. God bless you.